The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Liz Elliott from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, May 2019, Volume 20, Number 5. This is the fifth of five installments of the May issue. On the front cover this month, we see Oprah pictured against a white background. She's wearing a magenta self-belted sweater dress that comes just below the knee. The sleeves are long and it's slightly off-shouldered, like a boat neck. She pairs it with a pair of orange pointed pumps and accessorizes with a pair of pink earrings. They have a pink stone and they drop down from her ears. Her hair is blowing in the breeze and her arms are wide open and she's got a big smile on her face. The background of the cover is a bright white, and there is an orange rectangle in the top left corner, and it coordinates with the shoes that she's paired with her dress. And in her right hand, Oprah is holding a big white O against that orange background. It's the Oprah logo that's almost a perfect white circle, and the opening is a big oval in the center. And the quote on the front this month is, "It's possible to have many mothers. There's the one who gave birth to you, and then there are all the women who raised you up." And May is the Mother's Day issue, so we're going to begin with a brunch feature from the Let's Eat section. And the title of this article is "The Mother of All Brunches." And the background of the cover of this story looks like a marble countertop. And on the top of it, there is a bacon Gruyere breakfast pie. It's a rectangle. It almost resembles a pizza. There's a flaky pastry crust, and across the top of the breakfast pie, you see three eggs, cooked, I would say, over medium, and three slices of bacon and some herbs scattered artfully all over the breakfast pie. And the caption reads, "You could make restaurant reservations this Mother's Day, like everyone else and their mom, but there's something special about a home-cooked meal and something extra special about the recipes we've gathered here. We're talking pancakes tricked out with fresh flavor combinations, fancy French toast with a crunchy twist, and more updated classics that you don't have to be a mother to love." And now we're going to move to the recipes. The first one is simply for buttermilk pancakes. This makes 16 4-inch pancakes, and the total cooking time should be 45 minutes. 1.5 cups of all-purpose flour, 1/4 cup granulated sugar, 1.5 teaspoons of baking powder, 1 teaspoon of cinnamon, 1/2 teaspoon of baking soda, 1/2 teaspoon of kosher salt, 1 3/4 cup buttermilk or whole milk, 1 teaspoon vanilla extract, 2 large eggs, 3 tablespoons unsalted butter, melted, vegetable oil for the griddle or skillet, maple syrup for serving. Step 1. Preheat oven to 250 degrees. In a large bowl, whisk flour, sugar, baking powder, cinnamon, baking soda, and salt. In a small bowl, whisk buttermilk, vanilla, eggs, and butter. Add to flour mixture. Whisk until combined. Step 2. Over medium heat, warm a griddle or large skillet. Lightly oil. Onto griddle or skillet. Spoon about 1/4 cup batter for each pancake. Cook until air bubbles form on top and underside is golden brown, 2 to 3 minutes. Flip pancakes. Cook until golden brown on bottom, about 2 minutes more. Wrap in foil and transfer to warm oven. Repeat with remaining batter, lowering heat to prevent burning if pan gets too hot. Serve with maple syrup. Our next recipe is for bacon Gruyere breakfast pie. It makes a total of 6 slices, and your total time is around 55 minutes. Your ingredients are 1 sheet or 1/2 of a 17.3-ounce package of frozen puff pastry, thawed, 1/3 cup sour cream, 3/4 cup shredded Gruyere cheese, 4 slices of cooked bacon, 3 large eggs, 1/4 teaspoon kosher salt, 1/4 teaspoon ground black pepper, and thyme leaves for garnish. Step Step 1. Preheat the oven to 400 degrees. Step 2. On a large sheet of parchment paper, roll pastry to a 12-inch by 10-inch triangle. Fold half-inch from edges to form a rim. Using a fork, seal the rim and poke holes all over the pastry. Place on a baking sheet and bake until golden brown, which should take about 20 minutes. Step 3. Meanwhile, in a small bowl, combine the sour cream and the Gruyere. Spread onto the tart, creating 3 wells for the eggs. Crack 1 egg into each well and arrange the bacon on surrounding pastry. Sprinkle with salt and pepper. Step 4. Bake until egg whites are set, but yolks are still runny, which should take about 12 minutes. Garnish with thyme, slice, and serve. Our next recipe is for an apple Dutch baby. This was pictured in a cast iron pan, and it's a pastry sprinkled with roasted apples on the top. And it's garnished with some confectioner sugar and maybe a little cinnamon. This recipe makes 4 servings, and the total cooking time should be around 30 minutes. Your ingredients are 4 large eggs, 1 cup whole milk, 1 cup all-purpose flour, 1 1/4 teaspoons of vanilla extract divided, 3 tablespoons of sugar, 1/4 teaspoon of kosher salt plus a pinch, 3 tablespoons of unsalted butter divided, 1 large apple, such as a Gala or a Pink Lady, sliced, and 1/4 teaspoon of cinnamon, also confectioner sugar for dusting. Step 1. Preheat the oven to 425 degrees. On the stovetop, warm a medium cast iron skillet on medium heat. In a blender, puree the eggs, milk, flour, 1 teaspoon of the vanilla, sugar, and 1/4 teaspoon of the salt until combined, and scrape down the sides as necessary. In step 2, into the skillet, add 2 tablespoons of the butter, swirling the pan to make it melt. Then pour in the batter. Transfer to the oven and bake until puffed and golden brown, about 16 to 20 minutes. Step 3. Meanwhile, in a small skillet over medium heat, melt the remaining 1 tablespoon of butter. Stir in the apple, cinnamon, and a pinch of salt. Cook, stirring occasionally, 5 minutes. Then stir in the vanilla and cook until lightly caramelized, 2 to 3 minutes more. Remove from heat and cover. Step 4. When Dutch baby is done, top with warm cinnamon apples. Dust with confectioner's sugar and serve. Our next recipe is for potato latkes. This makes 20 small latkes, and the total cooking time is 30 minutes. Your ingredients are 2 large eggs, 1 teaspoon kosher salt, 1/4 teaspoon ground black pepper, 2 pounds medium russet potatoes, peeled, 2 medium onions peeled, 1/2 cup matzo meal, 8 tablespoons olive oil divided. Step 1. In a large bowl, whisk together eggs, salt, and pepper. Step 2. In a food processor fitted with a large grating disc or on large holes of a box grater, grate the potatoes and the onions. Add to bowl with eggs and toss to combine. Stir in matzo meal. Step 3. In large skillet over medium heat, warm 2 tablespoons of oil. Into skillet, gently drop 5 large spoonfuls potato mixture, about 1/4 cup each. Flatten to create even pancakes and cook until browned and crisp, 4 to 6 minutes per side. Transfer to a wire rack or paper towel lined plate. Step 4. Repeat with remaining potato mixture, adding oil to skillet as needed. When getting near the end of the potato mixture, strain and discard any liquid at the bottom of the bowl. Garnish with desired toppings and serve. And there's a column just to the right of the potato latke recipe with suggested latke toppings. The first is sour cream, dill, and pomegranate seeds. The second, sliced green apple, chopped scallion, and cracked pepper. The third, sliced beet, goat cheese, and lemon zest. The fourth, sautéed red onion and whole grain mustard. The fifth suggestion is sautéed apple and thyme. And their final suggestion is hard-boiled egg, capers, and parsley. And the final recipe in our brunch article is for citrus almond brioche French toast. This makes 6 servings, and the total time is 55 minutes. Your ingredients are 1 1/4 cup sliced almonds, divided, 1/2 cup of sugar, divided, kosher salt, 1 large egg, 4 tablespoons unsalted butter at room temperature, 1/4 teaspoon of almond extract, 1 tablespoon orange zest, 1/4 cup of orange juice, 1 tablespoon olive oil, 1 tablespoon thyme leaves, and 6 3/4 inch thick slices of brioche. Also, they suggest orange or grapefruit sliced for serving. Step 1. In a food processor, pulse 1/2 cup of almonds, 1/4 cup sugar, and a pinch of salt until finely ground. Add egg and butter. Process to form a paste. Add almond extract. Pulse to combine. Step 2. In a small saucepan over medium-high heat, simmer orange zest and juice, 1/4 cup water, and remaining 1/4 cup sugar, stirring until sugar dissolves. Remove from heat. Let cool. In a small bowl, combine olive oil, thyme, remaining 3/4 cup almonds, and a pinch of salt. Step 3. Preheat oven to 400 degrees. On a baking sheet, arrange bread slices. Brush with orange syrup until very moist. Then spread with an even layer of almond paste, about 2 heaping tablespoons. Top with almond mixture. Step 4. Bake until toasts are caramelized on edges and almonds are golden brown, 20 to 25 minutes. Serve with citrus and additional orange syrup if desired. And those are the recipes for the article, The Mother of All Brunches. Now we're going to move to the reading room, and I'm going to read an article entitled Belle Lettres. An Alabamian who now makes her home in Manhattan, Helen Ellis is both a gracious hostess renowned for her onion dip and a prize-winning poker player who holds her cards close to her twin set. After the novelist Colson Whitehead, who hired her as his coach for the 2011 World Series of Poker, saw her in action, he wrote, "The dudes flirted and condescended. Then this prim creature in a black sweater and pearls walloped them." The well-heeled heroines of Ellis's 2016 short story collection, American Housewife, are equally intriguing. Whether they're beating John Lithgow and Mario Batali on Dumpster Diving with the Stars, or discreetly murdering a series of troublesome doormen. Now, in her latest book, Southern Lady Code, published by Doubleday, the author introduces another charming, disarming literary persona, herself. Ellis's essays offer sly insights on manners and feminine mystique, which she recently discussed with O's executive editor, Amy Macklin. Amy Macklin asks, "In some ways, you're living the life of a character in American Housewife. Tidying up your East Side apartment, throwing fancy soirees. You make domesticity sound quite glamorous." Helen Ellis answers, "Well, it wasn't so exotic yesterday when I was scrubbing my toilet with my hair up in a unicorn horn, but I do like being a housewife. I started calling myself that because I didn't want to say I was a writer anymore. People would ask what I'd written for 16 years. The answer was nothing." Amy Macklin asks, "Though you're in one of New York's toniest zip codes, you found no palate is too refined for your grandmother's Hawaiian cheese log. Have you always been so unapologetic about your Dixie roots?" Helen Ellis replies, "I used to sweat over those little skewered canapés, but all anybody remembered was that cheese log, which is canned crushed pineapple, bell pepper, Worcestershire sauce, cream cheese rolled around in nuts. Now I just cook the things that no one admits they want to eat. I keep 3 jars of mayonnaise in my refrigerator, and my living room is covered in pink flamingo wallpaper. I think that's something people enjoy in Southern women. We create pageantry out of everyday life." Amy Macklin asks, "Southern lady code is the art of saying not-so-nice things in a smooth as silk way. Do you have any favorite examples?" Helen Ellis replies, Yes. Instead of saying, he's a hoarder, we'd refer to him as an archivist. And then there's the classic, bless your heart, which could mean, thank you for this funeral casserole, or it might be the last thing you hear before someone pushes you out of a moving car. Amy Macklin asks, you write, a good man is like a pair of bargain bin pricey panties. Snatch him up first and ignore tiny flaws later. That sounds so retro. Are you a feminist? Helen Ellis answers, absolutely. I consider myself a cross between Julia Sugarbaker from Designing Women and Dorothy Michaels and Tootsie. Now, even though one of those Southern ladies is actually a man, they both embody the idea that you can be traditionally feminine and still feel your power. Amy Macklin asks, both Julia and Dorothy have a lot of righteous anger, which seems to be another Southern woman specialty. Helen Ellis responds, we keep things bottled up, but when we let it out, forget it. Honestly, it feels fantastic to turn to a rude guest and say, get out of my house. Amy Macklin asks, speaking of letting it out, is your family scandalized that Southern Lady Code reveals so much of your personal life? Helen Ellis responds, the only piece I was nervous about is the one on my decision not to have children. I thought, now my mother's going to know about me and my husband's intimate life. Anyway, my mother's very supportive of my literary career. She says, Helen Michelle, your writing is like a dog's chew toy. It seems soft, but every now and then there's a sharp prong. Amy Macklin asks, is that why you love poker? Because you have a knack for deception? Helen Ellis answers, I love it because I can sit down to a table with strangers and don't have to entertain anyone. Amy Macklin responds, I thought entertaining was your favorite thing. Helen Ellis responds, what I like best about a party is the prep before everyone arrives and then the moment everyone leaves and I can congratulate myself on how successful it was. And no, it's never too late to send thank you notes. That wraps up the reading room this month, and now we're going to head to the refresh section. Our first article shows a lady in bed. All you see is her hair hanging out. She's lying down on a white sheet, and she's covering her face with another white sheet. Her nails are painted red, and her hair is hanging out of the sheet. And the title of the article is Life Messing with Your Hair? Blow drying, flat ironing, highlighting. You probably already know the damage they can do. But your diet, a stressful 9-to-5, even the air around you, can also have an impact. Uncover the sneaky culprits that could be at the root of your hair issues and learn what you can do to get thicker, shinier, and healthier on top. There's a list on the next page of all four things that could be the culprit for your hair problems. And up in the top right-hand corner of the page, we see the back of a lady working out. She's climbed up to the middle of an amphitheater. She is leaning over to her right. Her right hand is grabbing her right toe as she's stretching, and her left hand is stretched over her body. And you see her long hair hanging down. All you see is her hair. She's pictured from the back, and you just see the sun shining through her hair. And the caption beside it says, getting enough sleep and exercising regularly are good ways to minimize stress and, at the same time, help your hair. The first culprit, your crazed days. Work, deadlines, kids, skimping on sleep. Everyday tension can cause levels of the stress hormone cortisol to increase, leading to an inflammatory response throughout your body, says Melissa Palang, MD, a dermatologist at the Cleveland Clinic who specializes in hair issues. With too much inflammation, your body doesn't function properly. For hair, this can mean a shorter growth cycle, Palang says. The healthy hair fix? Learn to manage your stress. Getting enough sleep and exercising regularly are good ways to start. Do something every day that calms your mind, says Plang. Yoga, meditation, prayer. The next culprit, your diet. If you're seriously cutting carbs and calories in favor of more protein and fat, your waistline might not be the only thing that gets thinner. When you don't consume the right mix of nutrients, your hair is one of the first things to suffer, says Annabelle Kingsley, a trichologist and brand president at Philip Kingsley Clinics in London and New York. Slashing calories and nutrients and losing weight too quickly could cause your body to go into survival mode and shift energy away from growing hair to focus on more important stuff like staying alive. As a result, your scalp may feel drier and your hair might shed more than usual. Super low-carb diets in particular may deprive you of some hair-nourishing nutrients. Whole grains and whole grain bread are great sources of B vitamins, including B12 and biotin, both essential for hair growth, says Lindsay Bordone, MD, a dermatologist who specializes in hair and scalp at Columbia University Medical Center in New York City. Plus, certain foods may irritate. Full-fat dairy products and sugary snacks can cause a flare-up of dandruff, says Kingsley. The healthy hair fix? Lose weight slowly and healthfully to avoid sending shockwaves through your system, says Bordone. Aim for about a pound a week, and don't overly restrict any one food group. For a diet that's healthy for you and your hair, consider a balance of lean protein from things like poultry, fish, and eggs, 10 to 35% of your daily calories, fruits, vegetables, and complex carbohydrates, 45 to 65%, and fats, 20 to 35%. Also include omega-3s from walnuts and wild salmon, zinc from whole grains, seeds, and beans, and iron from leafy greens and lean cuts of red meat. The next culprit? Your environment. We hear a lot about pollution and UV light causing oxidative stress on skin, says Palang. These things can affect hair, too. Microparticles that float in the air from exhaust, smoke, and soot may coat your strands, giving them a dirty, less shiny appearance. Plus, a study in the journal Contact Dermatitis suggests that for many people, pollutants can trigger itchiness or prickly feelings on the scalp. Another issue for city dwellers? All that time pounding the pavement, which could mean more sun exposure. UV light degrades hair, similarly to the way bleach does, making it dehydrated, brittle, and dull, says Kingsley. The healthy hair fix? Shampoo regularly, that's every other day for many hair types, to get the grime off your scalp and strands, Palang says. For many women with tight coils or curls, who may wash their hair only once a week, rinsing with conditioner between shampoos, which is also known as co-washing, will help. When outside for long periods, protect your hair and scalp with a hat. Palang also suggests hair products that contain UV filters and antioxidants to help ward off sun damage. The final culprit? Your hormones. Late-night fridge raids. Sobbing during sappy commercials. We tend to blame a lot of things on hormones. And you can probably add brittle hair to the list. If your body produces too much or too little thyroid hormone, your hair can appear drier and thinner and shed more. If your hair sheds excessively, ask your doctor to check for thyroid abnormalities, says Palang. Especially if you're experiencing weight loss or gain, heat or cold intolerance, constipation, or fatigue. Waning estrogen levels as you approach and go through menopause can also affect your follicles, and over time, they may sprout finer hairs that don't grow as long, Kingsley says. Hair loss may also occur. The healthy hair fix? See your doctor for a thyroid check. Most hair changes due to these issues are reversible. After the condition is corrected, you should see an improvement in 3 to 6 months, says Palang. For menopause-related hair changes, talk to your gynecologist and dermatologist about your options for combating the effects of estrogen depletion, which may include hair regrowth treatments or hormone replacement therapy. And while we're on the topic of health, we will head now to the feeling good section. To the article, Should You Sip Your Supplements? You can now put medicinal plants and compounds in your morning beverage. What you need to know about a growing trend. A swig of juice, smoothie, or coffee used to be the way people washed down their morning multivitamin supplements, but increasingly, these drinks are the supplements. Cafes and smoothie bars offer menus of special wellness mix-ins and add-ons that promise to do much more than hydrate you. But there's a hitch. Those ingredients aren't reviewed by the FDA before being marketed, so generally no third party has verified claims of safety or authenticity, says Mark Moyad, MD, the Jenkins Director of Complementary and Alternative Medicine at the University of Michigan Medical Center and co-author of the Supplement Handbook. Here's what to know about three popular types of concoctions and ideas for what to stir into your drink instead. Under the heading, Think Twice, is activated charcoal. Inky black smoothies, chai teas, and lattes owe their goth hue to activated charcoal, made by burning coconut shells, coal, or wood, then heating it in the presence of a gas, such as CO2 or steam, to create microscopic nooks and crannies that bind to chemicals it comes into contact with. In hospitals, activated charcoal is used to treat drug overdoses and poisoning cases. In a drink, it supposedly detoxifies and draws impurities out of the body. But there's no scientific evidence to support this. Worse, if you consume activated charcoal within several hours of taking medication, you're playing with fire, says Tamara Duker-Fruman, a registered dietitian in New York City and the author of The Bloated Belly Whisperer. Charcoal will bind to some oral medications, like thyroid meds, statin, and birth control pills, before they have a chance to do their job. Activated charcoal may suck up vitamin C, too, so adding it to your green Latifa could be counterproductive. The next ingredient in the Think Twice column is collagen. Consuming collagen, a type of protein that's a building block of skin, is purported to improve skin's texture and luminosity. The thing is, collagen powders and supplements are broken down in the digestive system and absorbed throughout the body, says Eva Hurst, MD, director for the Center of Dermatologic and Cosmetic Surgery at Washington University in St. Louis. Our GI tract isn't smart enough to send it directly to the skin. Hurst says one study did find that women taking daily collagen supplements for 8 weeks had slightly smoother skin around the eyes, but it was just a small study of 114 women, and more research is necessary. Vegetarians take note. Collagen supplements are made from ground-up cow, chicken, pig, and fish parts. And the final ingredient under the Think Twice column is adaptogens. For centuries, these medicinal plants, herbs, and fungi have been used to help people relax and decrease stress reactions, likely in part by affecting cell communication in a way that dampens the fight-or-flight response. Now you can pay to add adaptogens like maca, ashwagandha, and cordyceps to your smoothie. But they're poorly understood and work in complex ways, says Alka Gupta, MD, co-founder and co-director of the Integrative Health and Well-Being Program at New York Presbyterian Hospital. At low doses in a latte or smoothie, they're generally non-toxic, Gupta says, but you won't likely feel effects immediately, if at all. When I prescribe adaptogens, I treat them as seriously as a medication, says Gupta. I'd be cautious of getting them from places other than a naturopathic physician or a medical practitioner who has experience with them. At least then you'll know what side effects, if any, could occur and why a certain adaptogen might make sense for you. Now moving to the try it column, the first ingredient is cauliflower. First, it replaced mashed potatoes and rice, then it stood in for pizza crust. Now cauliflower is sidling into smoothies, where it's used as a low-carb thickener. Fruman supports this move because cauliflower has a mild flavor that mixes well with fruit, plus it has fiber and antioxidants. Bonus! Some studies suggest that regular consumption of cruciferous vegetables may lower the risk of certain cancers. In recipes that call for a frozen banana, swap a heaping half cup of frozen florets or 1/3 cup of frozen riced cauliflower. And the final ingredient under the try it column is olive oil. Drizzling a tablespoon of extra virgin olive oil into your smoothie is a heart smart hack. Olive oil can help lower LDL cholesterol, the bad kind, decreasing heart risk. It also facilitates the absorption of fat-soluble vitamins A, D, E, and K, meaning you'll get more nutrients from dark leafy greens, citrus, kefir, or yogurt. Extra virgin olive oil shouldn't impact a smoothie's taste, Fruman says, but mixes best with ingredients like mango, berries, pineapple, chocolate, and cinnamon. Bottoms up! Now we'll move to our final feature article for the May 2019 issue of Oprah, and it's entitled, Where the Light Gets In. One man discovers the illuminating power of starting over. Keith Yamashita is an expert on what it takes to start fresh. His consulting firm, SY Partners, guides and supports companies through major transformations. But when he suffered a stroke at age 51, Yamashita faced his most challenging reboot yet, his own. In the pages that follow, he details this harrowing experience and the truths it revealed, truths that can be applied to any serious setback. Read Yamashita's extraordinary story and follow the companion prompts he's created to help spark a renewal of your own. I'm having a stroke, but I don't know it yet. I'm sitting in a car dealership in San Francisco, simultaneously trying to buy an SUV and conduct a work video conference on my laptop. This kind of efficiency is a symbol for my entire life. I am constantly trying to cram as much as I can into every moment, so much so that I'm not ever really fully present. I take a gulp from my stainless steel water bottle. Water leaks from my mouth and down my chin. Odd. Maybe I just wasn't paying attention. I take a bigger swig, more mindfully. All of it dribbles onto my shirt. I realize I can't purse my lips to keep the water inside. After a few more tries, I go off video and call my husband, Todd, who's in New York, to tell him something is happening to my face. Love, he says urgently, you have to get to the hospital. I make up an excuse to leave the video meeting early and tell the car salesman we need to finish up. No, there's no need to show me how the windows and locks work. I'm in a hurry. I grab the keys and shakily head off. The drive to the ER is filled with tribulations. Trying to exit the dealership, I'm stalled for 15 minutes by an 18-wheeler blocking me. Once I get going, I'm baffled by an endless series of wrong-way, one-way streets. I forget where the hospital is. And when I do find it, there's the matter of what to do with the car. By this point, my cognitive processing has so deteriorated that I don't remember how parking works. So I just turn the car off and get out. I try to lock it. Wrong button. Now the tailgate is open. I know it's not right, but I don't know what's wrong. I finally rush into the ER, where relief gives way to hopelessness when I see a long line of people in various stages of disrobement and disrepair waiting their turn. I'm doomed. When a security guard approaches and asks, "Why are you here?" Such a philosophical question at this moment. I tell him, "My face isn't working." Or rather, I mumble some poor facsimile thereof. "Go like this," he says, opening his eyes wide like moons. I try to mimic him, but can't. I cannot feel or control the right half of my face. Next thing I know, I'm lying on a gurney being wheeled at high speed into the MRI room, where I'm swallowed into a metal machine for 40 minutes as radio waves gather data about my besieged brain. It is insane, of course, that I drove myself to the ER in the middle of my own stroke. But that's how much I needed control, especially at this phase of my life. A little backstory. For the 25 years leading up to the stroke, I'd been focusing on the company I'd founded. And my passion for the work often meant I'd chosen board meetings over helping with homework. sending one more email instead of being home for dinner. I'd been a successful entrepreneur, but a bad dad to my two kids. My intuition had begun telling me that I needed to simplify my life and commit to being a better parent, but it was more than that. I'd been having premonitions that if I stayed in the frantic, always-on culture of New York City, something terrible would happen to me. It was hard to talk about this with Todd and the kids. It's hard to put words to things that aren't rational. But after nearly a year of discussions, I decided I had to go back to California, where we'd lived before moving to New York. I said that while I would love for the kids and Todd to come with me, it was time for me to leave, no matter what. This unilateral decision had not gone down well with the rest of the family. Still, we made a plan to move. Colette, 13, and Miles, 12, would come with me. Todd would join us later. Now, here in the hospital, less than 24 hours after our arrival in California, the terrible thing I feared would happen is happening. The lead resident crinkles his nose, swipes his forehead with his finger, warms up his vocal cords as if he's rehearsing a marriage proposal. He says, "You're having a stroke." At 51? It's happening at the base of your brain. When you're having a stroke, little moments drag out for impossibly long stretches. I examine every detail of the doctor's face, follow the curl of his lips. Seemingly at 1/10 speed, he tells me the stroke might continue to do damage to the base of my brain. Each word feels like another 10-pound weight on my chest. "The base of my brain?" I manage to ask. "What happens there?" "Breathing," he says. "Swallowing, bladder control, autonomic things like that." "Things like that," I whisper. I start to sob. For me, for my kids. I'm supposed to be protector, and I cannot even say my own name. The nurses leave me to sleep. Aloneness has always been my nemesis, and there are a few places more lonely than a hospital room. I reflexively pick up my briefcase to look for distraction. I find a poem. The final lines. "Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" Only this morning, these seemed like poignant questions for someone else. When I wake the next day, I can't bear to look in a mirror. But I know I have to reckon with the damage the stroke has done to my face. I pick up my phone to sneak a peek in selfie mode, and I can't unlock it. My face is no longer recognized as the passkey. I punch in the numerical code and hold the phone to take stock. No matter how hard I try to move my muscles, I have no power over my right eyebrow, eyelid, cheek, nostril, lip, or chin. It feels as if I'm trying to control someone else's face with my mind. Not a single twitch. As the hours unfurl, I will discover many more things I am unable to do. Speak clearly, for one. The sounds of the letters B, P, F, and M, among others, are impossible to create. Or drink. My mouth can't contain the liquid. Or eat. I can't tell where food ends and my mouth begins. I can't reliably swallow. It reminds me of the time 30 years ago when my apartment was robbed, but so neatly and carefully that at first I only noticed my TV was missing. I failed to realize that my boombox was also gone, that my watch had disappeared, and that the plates I ate from were nowhere to be found. The robbery unfolded as one dawning loss after another. I've always believed I was good with words, quick with ideas, skilled at charming people. These are my prized assets, the things that make me who I am. Now, I discover they can all be stolen in broad daylight. And no one is sure what else the future holds. The neurology team can't predict if or when I'll have a second stroke. My lead doctor runs some tests and draws a diagram of all the contributing health factors: high blood pressure, high cholesterol, high blood sugar, and insulin resistance, sleep apnea, chronic infections, the standard American diet, also called, appropriately enough, SAD, underhydration, lack of exercise, and above all, stress. I have to change my diet, manage my hypertensive and pre-diabetic conditions, take drugs to reduce my cholesterol. I need speech therapy, facial muscle therapy, brain oxygen therapies to help my nerves reconnect. 22 hours a week total. In an even bigger blow, the doctor says I'll be out of work for at least 6 months, probably longer. I have never taken off any considerable length of time. I finished college on a Friday, started my first job on Monday, and so it has gone on and on for the past 30 years. When I walk out of the hospital 3 days after I stumbled in, I'm walking into the unknown. In the days that follow, I try to pretend to other people that nothing has happened, but I'm literally wearing my disaster on my face. I attempt to fake my way through conversation with a neighbor, telling her things are going fine. Then she asks for the third time, "How are you, really?" And I break down in tears. At the local burger joint, they cannot understand me when I order, even though burgers are the only thing on the menu. I cannot fulfill even the simple fatherly duty of getting food for my kids. Coco and Miles have to help me with everything, counting my pills, answering my phone, remembering names and faces. I'm ashamed that not only am I a bad dad, now I'm a bad, useless dad, even though I never get a sense they've given up on me. I cry a lot, especially in any moment that points out how fragile life is. Will this be my last chance to help the kids buy clothes for a new school year? The last time I get to drop them off in the morning? The last Spider-Man movie we see? The good news is that I survived my stroke. The bad news is that if I want to keep living, I will have to exercise. This will require no small amount of bravery. As I know from my work, transformational moments often require us to confront negative beliefs. Here's one of mine. I am not an athlete. This belief dates back to 1971, when I was 5 years old and my father, a letterman in every sport he played, decided I was going to take up track. I became a pretty fast runner, but on the day of my first official meet, when I took my position on the track, I got confused. There was one boy, then another, each in his own lane, all ahead of me. Why was I in last place when the race hadn't even begun? No one had ever explained staggered starts to me. When the gun went off, I froze, while all the other boys raced forward. My parents had to come remove me from my frozen stance. I still feel the shame of walking back up into the stands with them. Masculinity, competition, physical prowess, they were indelibly sealed into one category: things I am not good at. And that negative belief grew stronger with every passing year. Now, some 45 years later, I am on seat 54, the very last bike in the very last row in a SoulCycle studio. Molly, our ebullient instructor, hops onto her bike at the front of the room. "Make sure you have everything you need to ride, your water, your towel, your juju." I'm struggling to clip my rental shoes into the metal holders on the bike's pedals. I think, "You have 2 Stanford degrees and you're going to be defeated by biking cleats?" The studio fills with music at ear-shattering decibels. "In here, we ride to the beat," Molly projects over the music. "I don't care if you look pretty." I'm flailing in a sea of perfectly synchronized legs. Once again, everyone is taking off without me. But suddenly, one shoe magically snaps in, then the other. The beat gets more intense. Molly's not so sunshiny anymore. Turn up the resistance! I'm already feeling plenty of resistance, literally and figuratively, but I twist the dial that makes the pedaling harder. And wow, it is much harder. I can't keep the beat, and I am not looking pretty. My sweat-drenched t-shirt is now so sheer it reveals my fat rolls. Molly is practically levitating, her hair gloriously suspended as if she's riding in front of a photo shoot fan. For the end sprint, everyone else stands, but I'm hunched over my handles, taking garbled gasp breaths. After class, as I stagger out, Molly says, "I'm happy you're here." I manage to not throw up in my towel, and this feels like victory. Renewal happens in the most ordinary ways. Over the next months, I see small signs of improvement. A tiny patch of feeling returns to my upper lip. A few weeks later, a tingle returns to my right eyebrow. A few weeks after that, I can move part of my nostril. My speech still sounds punch drunk, but I can basically be understood. And for the first time in my kids' lives, I'm home with them every day. The stroke has given me the chance to do what I wanted all along, be a better dad. As I'm discovering, this is all about the small moments. Finding the missing knee pads in time for soccer practice. Moderating sibling squabbles about who gets the front seat. I'm starting to meet Coco's new friends and getting to know them by name. We have a ritual. She's given all the girls code names. Apple, banana, pineapple. And tells me stories using these names. Sharing her friends' dilemmas and disappointments. I have no idea which girl is which name. Coco doesn't want me judging her friends when I see them in person. This way, she thinks, our conversation can be more pure. We have a lot of conversations now, multi-layered and complex. I feel like I really see our kids, perhaps for the first time ever. I'm driving. Miles is in the back seat. Coco is in the passenger seat. Our new rule is that the shotgun rider has DJ rights, so Coco is scrolling through the playlist on my phone. Suddenly, she sits bolt upright. "Dad, you have a playlist called My Funeral Songs? How incredibly morbid," she says, stretching out the syllables as only a teenager can. She taps the phone, and we listen to Earth, Wind, and Fire's September. It's followed by Superman Sidekick, written by my dear friend Michael Friedman. "Why are you so obsessed with your own death?" Coco says. "Is this because of the stroke?" I tell her, "It's not morbid. They're songs about how I want to live." I actually made the funeral songs list well before my stroke, on a friend's dare, and picked the songs that capture how I wanted to be in the world. It's kept me inspired during this time of recovery. A reminder of what my life is truly about. So much of the music we love isn't about just the notes, but what these notes evoke in our heart. Designing a funeral playlist allows you to spend some time with this question. How do you want to be remembered for the life you actually lived? Then you can come back to living that life with more clarity. We're going to do a death meditation now, says Jade LeBlanc, a willowy yogi from Los Angeles. Todd and I are at a wellness retreat, something we would never have done before my stroke, surrounded by 60 people we've just met. Jade's instructed us to sit in pairs across from each other, on the floor, knees touching. In all 28 years of our wondrous and sometimes turbulent marriage, Todd and I have never looked at each other so intensely in each other's eyes. Now Jade instructs us to close our eyes, so we do. Imagine you've just been tapped on the shoulder and told your time is up, she says. This is your last day on earth. I feel a chill throughout my body. Jade's guided meditation leads us down a long corridor where we meet the people who have mattered most to us, the one who believed in us most when we were children, the person we most need to forgive. Every scene she conjures feels as real to me as the physical world. We give each person's hands a final squeeze. Then Jade says, "Think of the person you love the most. Who has your heart? Visualize that person. Think about the joyful moments you've had. Think about your arguments, the things you've laughed at, the memories you've made. There's so much you need to say to this person on the last day you'll ever be together. You have so many thoughts, whole paragraphs, poems you want to share, but you only get one word." I think about all the things I'd want to say to Todd. "I love you. I wish I'd been more. I wish we'd had longer. I wish I hadn't hurt you." Then Jade says, "Now, say that word out loud." Todd and I lean toward each other to whisper in each other's ear. Then we both say, so simultaneously it could be one voice, "Sorry." We're crying. We hold each other tightly and can't let go. We're not out of time yet. We are still right here. What shall we make of this one wild and precious life? To delve further into the process of renewal, visit Keith Yamashita's website, a-human-being.com, where you'll find immersive podcasts that expand on the lessons offered here, including the full guided death meditation, as well as extended prompts to ignite insights that will enrich your journey. And finally, this month, we will wrap up with Oprah's What I Know For Sure column. "This will be my first Mother's Day on Earth without a mother." Many of you already know what that feels like. It's a reckoning with your own mortality. For me, it's neither lonely nor sad, just an undeniable marker of the passage of time. Time spent, time remaining, and how precious every moment is. My mother, in her final days, had the great gift of saying goodbye. I flew to Milwaukee 3 times in 1 week to be with her at her home. I could feel the end was near. She'd become not only weak, but weary and resigned. At one point, as we sat in the overheated little room with the big screen TV watching The Bold and the Beautiful, The Young and the Restless, and the game show channel's incessant run of Family Feud, I asked her, "Do you think you're going to make it through this?" She slowly shook her head. Shortly afterward, her caregiver for the past 14 years, Nurse Judy, came into the crowded room that was made even more crowded by the never-used exercise bike and the brown leather recliner my mother had always maintained as a personal throne. Their eyes met, and my mother reached for her and started to cry. I felt they were tears of gratitude, though she never said a word. She rarely showed emotion. We had a complicated relationship, my mother and I. This I know for sure. Now that she's gone, I understand it more clearly. When I left her on my second visit of the week, I was certain it was the last time I'd see her. Still, I could think of nothing more meaningful to say than, "Goodbye, I'll see you later." Pitiful for someone who's made a career of connecting with people. I went to fulfill a speaking engagement in Lowell, Massachusetts. When it was over, instead of heading home to California for a full day of meetings, I canceled everything and flew back to Milwaukee. "Don't be a hypocrite," I chided myself. "If this were anyone else, you'd tell them, leave nothing unsaid. And yet you've said nothing." I returned to close it, to finish the unfinished business with my mother. I spent another day in the hot room, just sitting and watching Family Feud on a loop. Again, I could think of nothing to talk about. though I knew I had buried plenty to say. I read the hospice manual cover to cover, the suggestions about memories to share, lessons learned, what your loved one taught you. I was empty of thoughts and feelings. That night, I went to bed and prayed for the right words to come, words without judgment or hint of resentment. What is my truth? I kept asking. The truth I need to speak to her to bring peace to both of us. With a new day came the answer. I woke, sat in silence, and then I reached for my phone and accidentally, if you believe in accidents, hit the music app with Mahalia Jackson singing, "Take My Hand, Precious Lord." I don't ever recall having downloaded Mahalia Jackson. I walked into the hot room with my phone playing Mahalia, and then had a better idea, to call my friend Wintley Phipps, the renowned gospel singer, and ask him to sing to my mother a cappella. He FaceTimed from his kitchen table in Florida at 8:38 in the morning, and with power and grace he baritoned, "Precious Lord, take my hand. Lead me on. Let me stand. I am tired. I am weak. I am worn." I could see it moved her. Wintley ended with a prayer for her and for our family. "Have no fear, just peace." That gave me the opening I'd been praying for. Looking directly into her eyes, I said these words. "I know it must have been hard for you as a 17-year-old pregnant, scared girl in Mississippi. Many people no doubt told you to get rid of that baby, to have an abortion or give me away. But you didn't, and for that I thank you. I know you did the best you could with what you had, and for that I thank you. And look how it all turned out." My sister, Pat, who found our family in 2010, having been given up for adoption in 1963, said, "Please forgive yourself for giving me away. I've forgiven you. I came back. We are your daughters, and we are here to help ease the transition. We are your daughters. We thank you for life." We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Please be sure to listen next time. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Liz Elliott, reading for Susan Dellinger and the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.